Yeah, I started when I was 11 or 12. My dad was a professor at a small college. He taught computer science, and my parents were divorced, and so I would visit him during the summer, and he didn't know what to do with us. So he just started taking all three of us to the classes he was teaching. And he was teaching, intro to basic and all that stuff back then. So I learned to program when I was like 12, and just immediately loved it, and spent all my time in the computer lab just hanging out with the actual students and programming. And I just wanted to be around computers, just crazy, like in love with the technology kind of thing.
What was the first kind of stuff you're doing? You're doing games?
No, I mean, I was so dumb. I didn't even know like basic math or anything, so I couldn't really do much of anything. I was just little short programs. And plus back then, I mean, it really was hard to do anything, because at that time when I started, we were dialing into a computer at the University of Georgia, which was, 300 miles away. And, we were dialing in at 110 baud. And, I actually started on teletypes. And so, you'd actually type in your thing, and it would, do it on paper and then scroll up a little bit, and then the computer would respond remotely. And, it's not a great way to type in programs. It's hard to do anything more than like 20 lines. So,
Wow, yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
yeah, it was weird. I miss those old machines. I actually really want to get an old TTY, the original one. There's one that where the keys are these cylinders that are like about an inch high. They come out of
Oh,
the
that's
case
cool.
like an inch high,
Do you have
and
to
it's
press
like
them all the way down? Like you got an in you have to press the whole inch to get
it wasn't that much play, but it was a lot of play. But I
it.
mean, it was so like incredibly retro future looking, and if you saw one today, it's just like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
That
And
is cool. Yeah.
there are ones that had this giant ball head. Maybe you remember ball head typewriters, but so
Yeah.
like, and it was just like really scary and really fast. And so as you type, this giant head would come up and just be like, "Whoa, bam!" and hit the tape and come back. You'd be like, "Whoa, Jesus!" And
Yeah,
it
those
was.
things remind me of like Terminator style futurism.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I really, really want one of those, actually. Right now I have an IMSI 8080 and my original Apple IIe.
Oh, you still have that?
Yeah, I still have the Apple IIe I got when I was like 15.
That's great. Was that the first computer you owned?
Yeah, and that was the one where I really started programming. Like before that, I didn't have access to computers. They weren't in schools. They weren't around. So, I actually used to like go to computer stores and just kind of hang out to be with the computers, but it's hard to do anything in front of there. And then finally, my mom took pity on me when I was 15. She's like, "All right, you're really serious about this." And she got my grandparents to buy me an Apple IIe, which was a huge expense for us. And
Yeah, but a good investment.
yeah, it really worked out for them and my mom in the end. So it's like, parents, buy your kids computers. I guess no one needs to be convinced of that anymore, but
Yeah. But no, I mean, at the time, a pretty forward-looking thing to do.
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, a lot of kids were getting, game systems and stuff like that, and I just wanted something I could program on. And
Yeah, that's, I never had a console growing up.
yeah.
All I had is, well, I had my Apple II when everybody else had like the original Nintendo and stuff.
Yeah.
So I was forced to make my own games and, mess around with it.
Yeah, it's kind of maddening that like the easiest, like all the systems that I would think about giving kids today just don't even you don't learn to program at all on them. They're all so easy, like an iPad, an iPhone, a Nintendo, whatever the current thing is. So it's just, back in the day, you had to learn how to type basic commands and interact with a computer, and you started learning stuff by osmosis. And,
Yeah, I do kind of, it's come up before, and I do kind of wonder if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe people get so comfortable with technology that it's not that big of a leap to program it. On the other hand, they're not exposed to how things actually work. They're just used to things just working.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, obviously I'm trying to, on one hand, fight for technology being much more accommodating to users. But on the other hand, I want my kids to have to suffer. I actually, I kind of think like all programmers should learn machine language first. I'm one of those people. And then after they figure out how machine language works, they're allowed to move to an object-oriented programming language.
Yep.
Skip over everything.
I kind of agree. Well, I think, well, it's kind of funny. I'm going to say that they should do exactly what I did.
So that could be that's weird, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like learn basic, you know, Pascal kind of thing. Then do assembly.
Uh-huh.
So that you know exactly how the machine is actually working. And then go to C and Objective-C and your favorite C++.
Yeah, that was exactly my journey, too. I guess that's what we did in those days.
Yeah. Well, because I think when you know how the thing's working, you can understand, like, the Objective-C runtime is reasonably obvious to you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's it, like, we haven't gotten to the age yet, and people keep thinking we're going to get to the age where, oh, you know, you just write in this super high-level programming language. You don't even worry about what the computer's doing. And we're not really there yet. Yeah. And, you know, like there's all these weird things, especially with Objective-C, like, trying to teach someone Objective-C and I'm like, oh, you know, you just say like self.bounds equals this. And they're like, oh, great. That's totally clear. Mm-hmm. But if I just want to change the origin, then I can just say self.bounds.origin equals
this. Right. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, no, you can't do that. Why not? I thought dot meant this. Well, it kind of means that, but it kind of doesn't mean that.
Yeah. I'm of two minds with that. I'm, you know, I try to just adopt what their direction that they're going in, because I think that's generally good policy. At the same time, that dot notation has some weird edge cases like that, where that dot is like the dot on a pointer does something different than the dot on a struct.
Yeah. And that's just, yeah. It's, but I mean, yeah, in general, it really cleans up the code and, you know, yeah. I use absolutely religiously, but
yeah.
It's kind of maddening that we have the old style and the new style, and they don't really work together. And
seems like the compiler could figure that out for you.
Yeah, you know, it really does. But I don't know.
Yeah, one day. Anyway, back to the story. So you get your Apple IIe, you're programming away. Where do you go from there?
Well, I basically spent, like, you know, every day, all day programming after I got my Apple IIe for, you know, until I left high school. That's all I did. Really stunningly, that's all I did. I didn't go on a date until college. I think I went over to somebody's house once after school when I was in 10th, like 11th, 9th, 10th, 11th grades, I think at 12th grade, it's like once maybe.
And then you just sat in front of their computer and programmed it?
Yeah. I would just come home, program in front of the computer until like midnight, 1 a.m. and then wake up late and be late for school every day. And
what were you fascinated by? What were you working on?
I would like write silly programs. I was trying to create a program, a drawing program, on the Apple IIe that, like, where you could edit an entire, because the Apple IIe screen was like 280 by 192 ish. Not sure.
Yeah. There's two character modes, right? Like 40 by something mm-hmm. and 80 by something.
Yeah.
But yeah, the
high-res screen. Right. And then there was double high-res too.
Yeah.
But the high-res screen. And so I was trying to create a program where you could edit enough dots that it would fill an entire piece of printer paper. Because at the time, nobody had like made a paint program where, you know, you could actually paint something that was 8.5 by 11. Like you could draw on the screen and then print the screen in the printer and it was microscopic.
Right.
And so I figured out with Apple IIe's banked RAM that you could, you know, you could bank in and out enough memory that you actually could fill a piece of printer paper. And then I made something so you could scroll around. And then that taught me to do, you know, really fast graphic lit operations and software.
Cool.
Yeah, I wrote a rect fill that I believe is the fastest color rect fill that ever existed on Apple IIe. I would make that assertion because it was, I went over and over and over in machine language until it was just unbelievably
couldn't get faster. Yeah, that's cool.
But I never actually, you know, shipped the program. I just diddled around and tried to, you know, figure out how to draw.
You were 15, and you know what? Shipping software in those days wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. No. I didn't really even know how you would ship something. I just was like, well, I got to create this, and so I did.
Yeah, that's great. So then you go to university.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, then I started working for my dad in the summers.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and so then he had a consulting business on the side, and so he just started having me program for his clients on the sly without telling them because he thought, you know, it wouldn't sound good to have a, like, 14, 15-year-old kid doing it. And after a while that, you know, they started noticing that I was always around. So they, you know, they sort of wised up to it eventually. Like, gosh, that kid's in front of the keyboard a lot. And I'm like, what, me? Oh, no. So we finally actually, you know, got me billing the clients directly. And
You know what? I've known you for a few years and never knew that. That's interesting. So you were doing client work.
When I was 15, yeah. And I was making $100 an hour with one of the clients. And so it was, and this was, you know, back in, you know, 1980. So it was like, I mean, it was, I made more then than I basically
$100 an hour in 1980. Man, you could afford a lot of Nintendo Power Gloves.
Yes. I mean, I was a very happy kid. It was very funny. and then on the, you know, I would play video games on the computers all the damn time. I just loved it. I had
any favorites? I was an Ultima guy myself.
You know, I never got the Ultima series. I wasn't able to get hold of it. I really loved the early stuff by Jordan Mechner.
Yes.
I mean, I loved everything he's ever done.
You know what? We had him on the show.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I know. I talked to him. I want to go listen to it, and I've never been able to because I'm like, I feel that I would hate myself for whatever I said to him.
Right.
I'm such a huge fan of his.
Yeah. All the wrong things. Yeah, he's just, in my mind, he's one of the absolute greats. Like, he's one of the people that not only can he program a million times better than me, but, you know, he's a better director, a better writer, a better everything.
Like, exactly. Yeah.
Just every game he's actually made and not just stuck his name on as a producer, has just been one of my favorite games ever. Like,
I totally agree. Prince of Persia was great. Karateka, obviously amazing. Yeah. The new one, equally good.
I really loved Sands of Time.
All of the sequels, they were done just up the street here at Ubisoft by a bunch of my pals.
Sorry, pals.
Not a lot of input from him on that. Like, they basically just took his name and started sticking it on random stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, supposedly they rebooted it with a new prince, and Jordan had more to do with that, I'm told.
About that one. Yeah.
But and so that one I think was actually called Prince of Persia, whereas the good one was Prince of Persia Sands of Time, right?
Yeah.
And I played it, and it was like, it was okay, but it was just really dumbed down controls. It was all actually QuickTime events instead of actually being, you know, you're not actually playing an arcade game. It was all QuickTime.
Huh.
They hit it, you know, but it was really just QuickTime. Like, you know, like on the original, there's in Sands of Time, there's wall walking, and you press a button to walk right along the wall. It's really cool. So in the new one, like, as long as you pressed a button within a second of running at a wall, it would run along the wall for a predetermined distance and then jump off automatically at the end. And it was always the same amount. You know, it was always the amount that the programmer had put in. Like, for this wall, he needs to run along for 30 feet. So
yeah, like a Dragon Slayer kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, that's not really a video game anymore. It's just Dragon Slayer. And so it really tore it apart. Plus, I had the world's biggest crush on Pharah from the original one. I have never loved a woman in video game as much as I loved Pharah. I was so immensely attracted to her. And that was like, and it was amazing that he'd managed to create this character where I'm like, oh my God, I love her.
I love the, I fell in love with the girl at the end of Karateka, or Karateka, as Jordan says. Wrongly. He's just wrong. I don't care. I loved it if you ran at her. If you came up to her slowly, she would just kill you. She'd just punch you out. Like, you had to just run at her. I loved that. That was such a great, such a terrific ending.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Okay, but we could just talk about Jordan forever. But
yeah, I know, seriously. So I'd play video games all the time, my Apple IIe, and I played a lot of NetHack, and then I programmed during the summers. Mm. You know, during the school year, I just tried to survive school because I just fucking hated it. I hated high school so much. I hated college too, but I really hated high school.
You don't? I was bad at school. Did you not like classes or homework? Or
I did. Well, I never did homework. That was my like thing. Is I was like, I was determined. You know, I wasn't going to be forced to do what they wanted me to do. So I literally never did it. Like I would, if I got to class and I had a few minutes before class, I would try to do the homework before class, right, if I can get my grade higher. But I was just determined I would never actually go home and do their homework, mm-hmm, which to me now seems insane. Like I'm like, that's the actions of an insane person.
Yeah.
Like just do the homework.
I've got some stuff like that from, I'll tell the story to you in person some of the time. basically I didn't do homework for an entire semester and then asked for like an 80% grade. I'll tell you how that happens.
The funny thing was, like in Canada, when I lived up in Canada for 3 years, I got, you know, really bad grades, not surprisingly, right? And then I moved down to Seattle and I got straight A's for 2 years. I did not get a single, you know, lower than A.
Huh.
Still had the policy. It's just American schools are dumb the fuck down.
Oh no.
there's no demonstration greater than that. So then I applied to colleges, and the colleges were all like, you know, oh, well, you don't have straight A's like every other student. And I'm like, well, I was in Canada. There's actually real. And they're like, yeah, we don't care.
So where did you go to college?
I ended up going to UW, University of Washington, which lucked out because I was right near me. And also it was at the time ranked like number three in terms of computer science programs.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually apply. I applied to all these like Ivy League schools because I didn't know anything about what I wanted to do with my life. And I was just like, well, I guess the next step in whatever is apply to schools, right? So I applied.
Were you thinking about doing a career in computers or?
I knew I was going to be in computers. I just didn't even like back then we didn't have, you know, app stores or anything like that. We didn't really have internet. So, you know, I had no idea how I'd be in computers. I figured somehow I'd work for Apple or something someday, but it was all kind of murky. And so I didn't actually even apply to UW, but I applied to all the other schools. I got rejected from everything but CMU. And CMU at the time didn't actually even have a computer science program. They just had a math for undergrads.
Hmm.
And they had graduate computer science. And so they were like, we'll give you a scholarship and you can major in math. And I'm like, I don't feel like I want to major in math. That seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, that's that weird comp sci old school confusion, right? Where it's like a lot of mathematical theory equals computer science.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm so bored with that crap. It's just not at all.
I'm actually pretty bad at math, despite having to use it quite a lot. I don't know about you, but.
Well, in high school, I was absolutely killer at math, and I like became like president of the math team and all this shit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I'm only good at lower math, which is kind of funny. So calculus and beyond, I'm like, I don't like it and I don't care. Yeah. It's just not interesting to me. And I know it's just because I'm not good at it. But everything else, I'm like, I love math, except the higher stuff. So I got to college and I'm like, all right, math, I'm good at this. And then wham, and just got killed. Just got hated. But so I got rejected from all these schools and I'm like, oh, suck. But then back then I just, you know, avoided everything. I was a really big procrastinator. And so it's like, you know, summer and it's going through summer and, you know, parents are like, what are you going to do with your life? Because, you know, college and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't know. And then one day the University of Washington calls me in Georgia and they're like, hey, you know, the SAT guys passed us your SAT scores. Because, you know, it's just a courtesy if you take SAT in Washington State. So we're cherry picking you. And yeah, we know you didn't apply and registration is closed now. But to apply now, we'll not only make sure you get in, but we'll give you a full ride scholarship. And in fact, we're going to give you so much money that you're going to have an excess. And so we're going to actually, you know, give you a salary to go to college.
What the hell? Good work, man.
And I was like, yay, I'm resolved.
Yeah, and procrastinating then, all summer pays off, basically.
I know. Once again, my plan pays off. So that was really nice. It was actually a scholarship funded by this really nice dude who just, he had, you know, like 200 scholars around the country that he he handpicked, and he wrote us all a note every year. And he was a,
That's cool.
And I just wasted it, and I feel so bad about it because I didn't go to class and I didn't care, and I was an indifferent student, and you know, spent all my time just in the computer lab, just trying to absorb everything. And
well, I just didn't. Seems like you got out of it what you wanted to get out of it, right?
Yeah, I did, but I still feel guilty for, you know, like not getting a degree. I mean, you know, I don't know. You're supposed to do certain things. And there's certain professors that just really, I don't know. They got actually like mad at me for the amount that, you know, because it's, I guess it's tough. You're a professor and you're like, here's the homework assignment. And it's like, someone just kind of like hands you a piece of paper that says, you know, meh on it. And they're like, you're not really taking this seriously, are you? And they're like, you know, mad. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I honestly don't care. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry. You know, you're allowed to care, and I respect that, but I don't. And
yeah, that's a tough job. I could see that being frustrating, but
yeah.
Like when you're a kid, you don't, well, whatever, when you're a youth, you're not really thinking like that, right? You don't have the life experience to be like, you know, I'm kind of being just being a dick to this guy.
Yeah. No, I mean, I fully admit I was such a dick when I was a kid. And I'm probably still, you know, in 10 years, I'm going to be like, oh, I was such a dick 10 years ago. But
yeah. That's good, though. It just means you're getting better. Right?
Yeah, so. I was definitely a dick 20 years ago. There's no doubt. I was a huge, huge, huge dick. But I did take all the computer science courses I could get my hands on. Like, I think I took every undergraduate CS course that was available. I took 5 years and just took everything. And that was great. It was a good education. And, you know, I got to meet some incredible people. One of the guys who did Smalltalk was there.
Really? Wow.
Amazingly wise person. That's and cool. he had a giant stuffed Wile E. Coyote on his door, which you gotta love a guy that does that, right?
Smalltalk and Wile E. Coyote. Yeah. I'm a fan.
But I actually, he was such a nice guy. I asked him to do a project, a special, like, you know, extra credit project, where I would do something cool in the next machines, which there were three on campus and two were in graduate labs in the CS building, and they were locked. And so I couldn't get into them. And so I was like, can I do a project? And he said, yes. And so I got a key to this next. And then from then on, I just spent all day and all night on this next machine.
Oh, that's great. So why were you excited about the next? Were you like a fan of like Steve's? Or
yeah, I mean, back then I was a huge fan of Steve's. I hadn't yet, you know, sort of encountered his more dickish side. And you know, I was a huge fan of the Mac. I never actually programmed one. And in fact, I bought one really late considering. But
I didn't buy a Mac till like 97 when he came back. Honestly, to get what was going to become OS X Rhapsody at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. My first Mac I like got in college and I only used it to like write papers. I never programmed that machine. So it was kind of funny. I have owned one just pure appliance computer, and that was it.
The toolbox would drive you nuts.
What's that?
A toolbox programming would.
Oh yeah, well I bought all the original books. I bought the Mac OS toolbox books in like 85. Yeah. Like I have the not the volume that's printed on the White Pages paper, but the one after that, the set where it's actually printed on real paper. And read through it. And I was just like, this is the worst thing ever. This is shit programming. Like, this is horrible. Like I expected so much and I couldn't wait to like jump into it. And I'm like, this is horrifying. And then in college I got into X11, really heavily. And I became an X11 programmer and like did my senior thesis. I created a drawing program, in X11, a little bit like Graffle, but,
cool.
Completely. But not the precursor. The precursor, that was something different.
Yeah.
But, and it was the same thing. It was just horrifying. Like they were trying to do object-oriented programming in C, and X11's interfaces are all this weird. Mm-hmm. Well, they were, I don't know what they are today, but there was this weird like C thing where they had this convention of structures where you'd have a structure and then you'd embed it in another structure. And that's like, and then there'd be pointers for calling functions in the structure. And then it would look in the superstructure first, and like this horrible, horrible, horrible thing, right? But at the end of the day, you sort of ended up with object oriented. I'm like, oh wow, you know, once you wrap your head around all this absolute batshit craziness, this is actually really powerful. But I hadn't, you know, been formally introduced to objective things really that much. Like I'd done a little small talk, but not really. So then I saw the next machine, and it just seemed like a beautiful box. And I had always wanted Unix on my desktop because when I was 14, 15, I was learning on Unix machines, not on. Actually, well, first I was learning on cyber NOS machines. But after the cyber NOS, I was learning on Unix, and so I always wanted Unix. And so my dad kept sending me his clippings, you know, like, this is literally back in the day when someone would clip an article out of a newspaper and mail it to you physically through the mail. Like, can you even imagine? Like, I'm so dating myself here.
Yeah. Everybody's, like Google Reader shutting off in a couple of days and everybody's freaking out. But
yeah, exactly.
Back like, in the day.
You're like, clip, 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 click, 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 mail, mail, mail. Yeah. Walk down to the post office. Like, what the hell? So he kept sending clippings from InfoWorld about the new machine that was coming out, this like super megapixel Mac that runs Unix that the job is going to do. And I was like already. And then, you know, it came out just as I hit college and I was like, I want to play with this.
That's great. I remember that InfoWorld thing. I think I first saw it in the magazine at the library. And I was like, okay, this looks amazing.
Yeah.
Super excited about it. But I'd never had a chance to get anywhere near one. So you get the key to the next. And
yeah.
And I'm never looked back.
Yeah, I was on it. It was running NextStep 0.8, and I learned.
Wow. I thought 9 was the initial release.
Yeah, it was. But
Wow.
But
so,
the guy at the UW, the UW's IT director was actually friends with Steve Jobs. And so Steve made sure that we had three machines before like anyone else. So
wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's funny because there are a couple guys at Apple still that beat me to it. Like I think Bill Bumgarner.
That was going to be my guess. Yeah,
one of them. But so yeah, so I learned Objective-C and you know the AppKit, and the AppKit is just, you know, it's a work of art, and it was and it was, you know, that I place entirely on William Parker's. He had this vision and, you know, guided IB and guided AppKit and
I hear a lot of griping about AppKit these days, but. You know, it's been around a long time, and it still does remarkable things.
I have not been able to figure out what he's up to. Like, he was doing stuff at Microsoft for a while, and Parker's, but I don't know what he. I don't know what he did after that. He wrote me some email like a couple of years ago, and I was really flattered. I was actually, because I was young and a jerk, when he actually left Next and went to Microsoft. I think I blogged something or said something. Where I was like, you know, goddamn sellout or some shit. I'm all judging him, right? And so he actually told me eventually and was like, you know, hey, I'm doing this and, you know, want to say hi.
Yeah, that's cool.
I know you think I'm a sellout or whatever. And I wrote him like, I am so sorry. You know, I was a young, jerky kid. I'm no position to judge you.
Yeah, he probably had something really interesting at Microsoft. It's not like you do AppKit and then you're like, well, I'm going to go phone it in at Microsoft working in the guts of Excel, you know?
Well, I mean, Microsoft has this habit of hiring people just to make sure the rest of the industry doesn't. Like, they hire a ton of brilliant people and make them fellows, and they're just like, we're paying you to not work
not
for our
compete
competitors.
With us, right.
Yeah. And like, you know, and that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but geez Louise, I've seen a lot of examples of that happening. Even if they didn't try to, it's just happened a lot. So I don't know. So at the time I considered it, we were fighting for AppKit and Objective-C's very existence. We were fighting for whether or not the next generation of programmers was going to be working for companies like Microsoft, where hundreds of people were, you know, working on one product and they were all doing like one button a piece and software only came from big companies, which, you know, it really was during the 90s.
Mm-hmm. This is what, well, like 94 or 5 kind of time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
when they were trying to do
like everyone was dying to Microsoft. You know, you couldn't compete with Microsoft. Like, it was a joke. Like, everyone just thought, oh, it's just a matter of days until Quicken goes to Microsoft. It's a matter of days because, you know, they'd taken everything else. Like, there used to be, you know, when I was young, there used to be like 6 or 7 word processors and you know, there's WordPerfect, there was, you know, all these different things, right? And now it's Word. No one even knows that there's multiple word processors. They're just like, well, of course, Word. And I'm like, well, back when I was a kid, there was choice. I know it's crazy to think about. And I was watching just industry after industry just get swallowed up, you know, by Microsoft. And so I was so afraid that's what programming would become, is it become like the giant car companies where it's like, oh, you want to make cars? Fine, go work for General Motors and weld doors on cars for your life.
Yeah.
And we were in danger of that. And then I saw, you know, object-oriented programming and the frameworks that we had that were so powerful. as a way to fight it. So, you know, I was like, it was my life's mission to win, to have these frameworks win. That was like, I had one goal, and that goal was they will win.
Well, job well done.
It's kind of neat because, yeah, I never thought that, you know, within 10 years, we'd be, you know, the majority operating system in the world. That's just bizarre. That's just, it seems unlikely. I mean, ignoring, you know, like completely embedded systems, of course, but, right, you know, the majority operating system for which a general person can program for and write programs, like, we're it, right? Like
Objective-C, Foundation.
Yeah.
All the, you know, UI app kit.
Flipping bizarre. And even, you know, even ignoring, you know, just iOS and OS 10, you know, the whole message of you need to have powerful frameworks on top of an object-oriented language has really sunk in. You know, I don't care if you like Ruby or whatever.
So like even Microsoft .NET stuff, you count as a win, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, so we won that battle. And, you know, it wasn't a given. You know, we lost it the first time. I mean, we didn't. I wasn't around. Well, yeah. I was an embryo. And Smalltalk came out, right? And lost. Smalltalk lost. And I was like, everyone thought Objective-C was going to be another curiosity like Smalltalk. Like, yeah, it's cute, but seriously. And even when Apple bought Next, remember, in 97, you know.
It still wasn't clear, yeah.
Oh, everyone at Apple thought Objective-C was just way too radical. And
hence the Java Bridge, right?
Yeah, well, the Java Bridge. And then internally, they had decided. There was a decision that they were going to make Java the main language of Next Step.
I didn't know that.
And they rewrote all of the shipping apps in Java. So TextEdit was in Java, like Mail was in Java. They redid all these things in Java.
Ouch.
And I don't think they ever finished that work. They were like doing it to demonstrate, you know, oh yeah, you can do all the frameworks from Java.
I knew TextEdit because I think they shipped the source with one release and it was Java. Yeah.
Yeah, and so they were trying to do that because they're like, there's no way anyone will ever accept Objective-C. We have to give up. And, you know, and it's so funny because, you know, Java is now ranked, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's actually, I guess it's pretty well like supported now. But, man, I don't know a lot of, like, desktop software that runs Java. Like, I can't name
it. And if you see it, it's just horrible. It's like clearly not platform native at all. But whatever, enterprise servery stuff seems to.
I guess, fun. You know, but. Yeah. But then if we look at it, you know, what's your general feeling toward enterprise server software? It's generally actually pretty slow, buggy, and not very featureful, right? And I'm like, that's exactly what I associate with Java, is that it's really hard to optimize and to extend once you get into it.
Yeah. So the one thing that did switch is that they took WebObjects and made that Java, and that's stuck.
Yeah, and then that's how they lost Craig, actually.
Oh, yeah? Well, that was it.
Right. Craig was on the – well, I mean, I can't speak to his, you know, exact motives. But Craig was on the Enterprise Objects team, and he was brought in fairly late. I want to say, like, 93. And you know, and he was just, of course, just incredibly brilliant and fantastically charming beyond all belief. Uh-huh. And, you know, and helpful and just
– good head.
I mean, yeah, he's just Superman. Like, it's really weird. And
a lot of nice things about that guy.
I think within a year he was running the UF team at Next. Mm-hmm. And back then, Next had, you know, kept trying to figure out what their success was coming from. And finally with EOF, like every Fortune 500 company was sniffing around them because they were like, oh, you want to get on this new thing called the web? Well, Enterprise Objects can give you actually a smart website instead of a dumb one, and we can do it easy. And there were just no other frameworks, none of the other things that people use today existed. It was like, you want to program raw HTML or do you want to use web objects?
Right. The original Dell online store was web objects and EOF.
Yeah. Toyota, Kabuto, literally, you know, we programmed. And so at the time we got into the consulting for all these people. And so, you know, our client list, it was hilarious because we had this client list. It was two different Swiss banks, Union Bank of Switzerland and Swiss Bank Corporation, which is hilarious because, I mean, they really just have so much money. Like, we tried to negotiate with them, and they would be negotiating up our fees. I am not actually.
Really?
Yeah. We actually did a thing where we were like, you know, they're like, well, what would you bid on for this component? I'm like, I don't know, 80,000. And they were like clearly so horrified that we weren't charging enough. They're like, well, why don't we round it up to 100,000 and just And, you know, and then you can, you know, support it afterwards. That'll include support or whatever. And I was just like, man, I'm underbidding. And like, I realize you guys are just literally sitting on piles of gold. Like they literally just, their chair is, yeah. You know, they don't have Aeons. They actually
at that time, it's literally Nazi gold too.
Yeah, it was actually, yes. I mean, that was before. Yeah. So yeah. I was like, wow, that they really just have too much Nazi gold. And they're like, before we get audited. So yeah, it was a crazy time because you know, Enterprise Objects was absolutely wagging the dog at that point. Like,
right.
Next had this product called Enterprise Objects that was just kind of like an afterthought thrown onto, you know, what was DBKit.
Yeah.
DBKit became Enterprise Objects, and then they threw on Web Objects onto Enterprise Objects, and then suddenly Web Objects was just selling these things. Originally McCaw Cellular, which you now know as AT&T Wireless. All of their customer care, customer acquisition, everything, their whole IT was on NextApp.
Hmm.
And you know, it was because of EOF, actually. And so we're doing all this consulting stuff at the time, and it was all great. And then Apple's like, oh, Java's the wave of the future. We're just going to port it all to Java. And so they ported the whole framework to Java, and it was just slow as fucking shit and buggy as crap. And it was just horrifying. And this was our big introduction to Java too. So this is why to this day, I'm like
bitter.
Pissing. Yeah. And then a bunch of the EOF engineers who were really good and loved the product were like, yeah, we're done. Okay. We're leaving. Cause this is ridiculous. Like I can't with a straight face tell all my clients to port to a new language, to get the latest version so that they can be slower and buggier. And this is, it's actually, this is, you know, coincidence. I am not taking credit for this, but I did actually, I used to write Craig like every year and, he was in this other company called like Ariba.
And wait, what do they do?
I don't know. I just think it's a funny name. Ariba.
They do something interesting, I think, but whatever.
Yeah. I feel like I just know the name because of, you know, the Speedy Gonzalez. But I used to write them and be like, you've got to come back to Apple. Like it's amazing now. You know, you're such a great engineer. And, you know, I think at the time I was like, I bet you they might put you in charge of AppKit even, you know, right? Like I was like, you know, an engineer as good as you, I bet you'll get, you know,
you'll get something good.
Under you. At least be, you know, a manager, you know, maybe two people under you. Right. and then 1 year they announced and, you know, and I didn't have any previous warning or anything, but 1 year they announced and they're like, oh yeah, we're bringing back Craig Pickering. And then they didn't actually say, they kind of hinted what he was doing, but you know, he was actually, so Bertrand decided he wanted to leave. Right.
Yeah.
And so they were going to have a year of overlap where they let Craig, you know,
acclimatize to the,
And so then suddenly a year later, they're like, oh, now Craig is taking Bertrand's job as VP of, you know, software. And I was like, holy crap. Like, what the hell?
That's awesome. Yeah. There have been a lot of really good guys up there. It was Avi at first and then Bertrand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Avi was, I mean, he's.
Well, he wrote Mach, so.
He's such a solid engineer and he's so. Yeah. He's one of the people where his, like, I mean, engineer, like, he's an old school, like, he could build bridges engineer, which I can't, right? I'm more of the flouncy artisty kind of programmer than the.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Good God, nobody go near a bridge that I've built.
Yes. Yes, exactly. But he was a real engineer. So like one of my favorite Avi stories is he actually called us down, like, you know, the three guys running Omni, right? To California. And we're like, you know, Avi tells you to come down, you come down, right? Yeah. So we fly down and you know, we go into this conference room, we have no idea what to expect. We met his assistant, who's really, really nice lady. And he's like, he's got like a laptop. And he like flips it around toward us and he's like, see these numbers? Like, what's with your VM use? And we're like, hi, nice to meet you. And we're like, oh, our VM use is bad. And he's like, yeah, I don't understand why you're not running, you know, nmstat minus VM Q25667 every day in a terminal when you run your app. Because
what apps are you talking about? OmniWeb?
OmniWeb. Mm. OmniWeb, you know, like one. Or two, maybe two. And it was their only web browser at the time. And they were like, sucks, you know, it's slow and crappy. And, you know, it was slow and crappy. And we were like, we'd never heard of these tools. Like, literally, we had no idea. We're like, there's a way you can measure memory? And he's like, ah! He's so mad. We're like, so wait. What you're telling me is this system has a limited amount of memory, and you can tell? So, yeah. So it was really just like, you know, get this fixed. And we're like, yes, sir.
That's awesome.
It was really funny.
I love the way he drags you down there just to.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you couldn't have just emailed us?
Yeah. Like, can we video conference this? No. Yeah. he needed to look us right in the eyes.
Yeah.
Burn like it really was like we were puppies, right? And he's like, what is this? What is this? And he rubs our nose in it. And we're like, oh, we're sorry. And like literally we never did it again. Like we just have a program, we're like, now run that tool. Yeah. Back in the day, we didn't have this, you know, activity monitor constantly running that just tells you.
Right. Yeah.
That wasn't a thing. And then, you know, we certainly didn't have instruments. So, you know, it wasn't just trivial.
Yeah, you'd have to actually be aware of that and try to figure it all out. So
you'd have to know all the command line tools to check your sizes. And I'm like, I didn't even know about these mock commands. I grew up in Unix.
Yeah. Of course he does, because he wrote this stupid thing.
Yeah, kind of unfair.
So we skipped over, but you're playing with the next in the lab, and I think you meet up with, Ken and Tim and start up the Omni Group?
Yeah. Back in those days, there were two whole computer centers on campus besides outside of the computer engineering building. There were two computer centers just for, you know, average people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the director of IT there did, the funny thing is, I remember his name, and I'm probably getting his name wrong because I know that this name overlaps with another famous name, but I think the guy's name was Ron Johnson.
Hmm.
And I don't think it was the same Ron Johnson, but I could be wrong. And I
haven't. That'd be hilarious. It would be great if it was. But yeah.
Yeah. And at the time, he was actually Ken's boss, because Ken was working in IT at the UW as well as, like, he was like a seventh year student at that point. Mm-hmm. And so there were like two general computing centers, and the UW was, I guess, fairly progressive in the nation, and they had opened up computing centers to all the students. And what they call uniform access, which was like, you know, revolution to be like, oh, what if we just let English majors touch our computers? And you know, that was like, whoa, crazy times.
Yeah.
And so there was this little culture of kids that hung out in the computer centers. And you know, I was like, hey, you're my kind of nerds. Yeah. So I hung out there, and that's how I ended up meeting Tim and Ken at the UW. And through, you know, hanging out at the various computer centers, like I got to meet some other people I, you know, thought were pretty cool. And one of them was a programmer who still works at Apple to this day, actually, called Dan Fly, who was working on this multiplayer game on, like, I think he was writing under VMS at the time. And he wanted to make this multiplayer, like, you know, sort of like NetHackish kind of game. And I was like, oh my God, we should write these on next boxes. Mm-hmm. And so then I started planning this game, and I pulled this group together to meet, like, you know, every couple of weeks, and we'd eat and we'd get, you know, silly, and we'd supposedly plan the game.
Yeah. So the fun was the planning the game. And then,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the game that Dan had come up with, the name of the game was Omni. So the name of the group that I, you know, asked to meet, I called them the Omni Group. And it was, you know, a group of cool programmers. So meanwhile, at the same time, I'm working at the University of Washington as a consultant, a student consultant in the computer lab, which meant I was supposed to answer other students' questions about computers, but I really hated being interrupted while I was programming.
Yeah.
And so I would just sit there programming, and then, you know, people would come up and I'd let everybody else that was working with me answer their questions, which, you know, in retrospect, like, I'm like, I feel super bad about that. Cause, you know, like, mega jerk move, but
yeah.
But, you know, at the time, you know, like, listen,
you're a dick 15 years ago.
Yeah. I was a dick.
It's just,
I'm like, I know.
I'm going to end up making this a running theme that, like, you were kind of a dick when we started this interview. So
yeah. No, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
just kidding.
Go, such a dick, and I'm still learning. But eventually I get fired from that job, and not because of, you know, gross incompetence, but because I made a sexist joke, and someone mailed it to someone else, and eventually it got mailed around enough, and someone complained, and I'm like, at the time it was funny because, you know, it was the whole idea of is email private wasn't really well established, right?
Yeah.
Nowadays I think there'd be a giant civil case, and it'd be like, you know, well, you can't, if someone mails you privately a joke and you mail it around, it's not their fault if other people are offended.
Probably. Yeah.
But
well, anyway, etiquette hadn't been established yet, right? Yeah.
So I actually went to my supervisor and I was like, you know, I don't think it's fair that I'm being disciplined for private mail that I sent to somebody that person found funny. Like, it wasn't like the person that I mailed it to didn't find it funny.
Yeah.
He did. But then he forwarded on some other people and eventually someone didn't find it funny. Right.
Right.
Well, that's not really my fault anymore. It's his.
Yeah.
but so
yeah, you made a joke inside a context where it worked and the context changed. It's
just, yeah.
It's not, like, that's not your fault.
It's not my fault. And so this guy looks at me and he had actually only, you know, relatively recently taken over the position of running all the consulting, you know, all the consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And he was this really smart guy and a really good manager. And I'm really sad I've forgotten his name because I just owe him this incredible debt. He looks at me, he's like, "Well, you're incredibly bored and you're clearly meant for great things. It's time for you to just stop fucking around at this job and just, you know, do them. Just stop hiding."
Mm.
He's like, "Look, I'm going to put you on suspension for 3 months for the summer and you're going to go get another job. And then if you really want this job in 3 months, come back and, you know, we'll talk then."
Hmm.
And I was like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah.
And then this is one of the stories that, like, you can't even make it up. Like, if it were a movie, you know, you wouldn't believe it if it were a movie. So I literally got on my motorcycle and I drove across the water to Kirkland, which is where the Next headquarters was.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the Seattle Next headquarters, the most expensive office space in the city, by the way. I mean, literally it was in a zone by itself in terms of office space. Steve picked the most expensive zone he could and put his office. So I went to the office and they knew me because I'd been their sort of informal sales rep on campus, as it were. And I showed up and I'm like, "Hey, I need a lot more hours because I just got fired." And this guy named Jerry Good, who is a systems engineer at Next in the Seattle office, looks at me and he's like, "You know, this is a weird coincidence because one of the very first things when the Next machines were first announced, there was a company, what was then the world's largest talent agency, William Morris Agency.
Mm-hmm.
They bought a bunch of them. They bought, like, you know, 150, which was an obscene amount of $10,000 computers.
Yeah.
But they did it with the proviso that Next would write them custom software to run their business.
What do they need 150 of them for?
They were putting them on every agent's desk and every assistant's desk.
Wow.
At the entire company.
That's cool. Yeah, that's all in on this. Yeah.
It was a lot. Yeah, they betted big on these beautiful. I mean, you know, they're a talent agency, so I'm sure part of it was they're like, "These machines are sexy, let's do it."
Yeah.
So they wanted all this custom software, and supposedly Next was to be good at it. So then they hired Next, was like, "Oh, we're on the hook to write this software. We don't want to do it." So they hired some subcontractor, this company that I've had sort of rivalry with ever since. these guys are still around, by the way. Or actually, I think some of them are. Anyway, so they hired this company, and then a year later, they went to the company, they're like, "What's going on?" And the company's like, "Oh, we've sort of got some mock-ups, and we burned through $1 million. And they're like, and this was back, you know, before programmers were making obscene amounts of money. So $1 million was a lot back in 92. Mm. And so they looked at it, and they're like, "None of this shit you've done is usable. And you're fired."
Yeah.
And then Next is like, "Great. We've burned through, like, the money that Wayne Morris has given us because they gave us like $1 million for software and you spent it all. So we have no money. We're already late and we need to start again." And then they bring me in. Me. They're like, "Yep, you're hired. You're our guy." I'm like, I'm 21 and I'm still in college. You're like, "Yep."
Wow.
like this is just how desperate they were, right? Like,
yeah.
Like they're like clearly you're gonna do better, and I'm like, well, I guess, you know, I'm not gonna spend as much money.
Yeah.
So I started programming, and then like in a week, 2 weeks, Jerry was like, "Wow, you're actually doing results. Do you know anybody else like you?" I'm like, "Well, yes, I do. I know Len Case and Ken Case and Tim Wood, and from my group of game designers, my Omni group."
Yeah.
And he was like, "All right, they're hired."
And nice.
Eventually, I think he had like eight of us working out of their office there. But we were all working directly for Next, or actually back then everybody was consultants all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all consulting directly for Next. We didn't have a company.
Yeah, it was right. You all individually,
yeah,
contracting to Next rather than, yeah. So when do you guys get together and get your own office?
Well, so after like I think a year of that, Next was like, okay, we're really sick of just bleeding money here. Mm-hmm. So we're going to call this pretty good and hand you off to another company, because we don't trust you guys enough to just, you know, be talking to Waymoris directly. So we're going to hand you off to a company called SHL System House, which has been renamed 20 times, but I think parts of it still exist. And I think parts of it were in a giant scandal recently, actually.
SHL System House, that's a shitty name.
Yeah, it's a Canadian company, actually. And I think I think when they were called System House, they were like part of the Enron scandal or something like that. It was really bad. One of those companies like Anderson Consulting, who we also used to work with, who, you know, they had to change their name after all the scandals.
Yeah.
But so they handed the contract off to SHL System House, who then, you know, immediately subcontracted with us because there was no actual talent at SHL System House. And so we were again subcontracting, but for SHL System House. And we were making a lot more money because at that, you know, time we were allowed to renegotiate, and we all renegotiated. But we all renegotiated individually, actually. So it turned out Ken was making like three times what the rest of us were. And we're like, damn it. and so we're making a lot of money, and we're working like long hours. And we moved out of the Next office, and we found a cool little like office space, really quirky and fun. And then we kept sending bills to the System House. And eventually, like, I think the Canadian government was like, you can't, you know, to SHL, you can't be paying checks for like, you know, $15,000 a month to individuals.
Mm.
Like, that's, you know, you've got to do some sort of crazy withholding or something. That's not okay to just be like, oh, they're consultants, it's fine. And so they said, you guys have got to incorporate, or we can't keep paying you.
Mm.
And so, like, all right. And so we incorporated in October of 1993, the name the Omni Group. Except somebody had already taken the Omni Group in Seattle, so we actually incorporated under Omni Development because we were actually afraid of name change, which was dumb because we should have just done it because, I mean, Jesus, it was a totally different group, but whatever.
Well, whatever. No point getting in a fight.
Yeah. So that was the story of the first, you know, incorporation.
So how did you guys get into products? Because when I start to become aware of you guys in like 96, 97, when like, you know, I was reading a lot about Next earlier than that because as a game guy, I'd read everything I could about or from Carmack, and he developed Doom on the Next and the editor. So I'd come to it from that angle. It's like, okay, this is an awesome platform and I want to get into it. But cost a fortune and I can't get my hands on a machine.
Yeah.
So when did you guys start doing products?
Well, we sort of were always diddling with products. I mean, I always loved product, of course. I don't think anybody ever is like, oh boy, I want to consult. So like when I was at the college, I wrote a newsreader, which, you know, for the kids out there, news.
You mean Usenet, not
Usenet. Yeah. And back then Usenet wasn't just a great way to get pornography. It was, it was essentially what Reddit is now. That's how I think of it. Like, it's a bunch of arguing and craziness and stuff. So I wrote a newsreader for the Next, and it was like, you know, a graphic front end, nice, you know, one of the first, you know, this is back before every single thing ever had, you know, a nice graphical client. So I was like, hey, check it out, graphical client. And unfortunately, some guy at Next also wrote a graphical front end.
Oops.
He felt like there was a rivalry, and I kind of didn't, because I was just giving mine away, and I just, you know, I'm like, I just did it for fun.
Mm.
But like, he's sniped at me ever since, and I'm like, I don't get why we don't like. As far as I know, I've never said a bad thing about him. But if I have, I apologize profusely. I certainly don't have any bad thoughts or feelings.
Yeah.
But yeah, my first introduction to him was not good either. I had a reputation for, well, I made a mistake once, and I leaked some information that I shouldn't have back in the early days of Next to the Usenet. And, you know, that's back when you're young and you don't realize that, you know, people read the net, right? Like, and right. I think every young person does this, where they're like, oh, I just found out a cool rumor from Apple. Like, one of my friends told me, I'll post it on the net, and then, you know, everybody will think I'm cool. And then someone from Apple calls them and goes, dude, you're a dick. You just got me in trouble. And they're like, oh, you read the net? And then you realize, oh, geez, you know, of course. Yeah. it's kind of obvious in retrospect.
Yeah, that's not a good use of your political currency. Or
yeah. So this guy, you know, he was sort of like tasked with telling me, you know, that's not okay. You don't ever do that again. And I'm like, yeah. And I made sure, I still tell my young programmers to this day, I'm like, no, you know, we don't do anything that could even be seen as potentially possibly leaking secrets, because it gets back to them and then they don't tell you anything anymore. And you never know they're not telling you. You just don't ever hear anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'd written a newsreader. And then, you know, I always tried to have some product that I was playing with. We wrote Omni Image, which was a way to look at, you know, GIF files and then JPEGs and stuff. Because that wasn't just, you know, automatic back then. Like, you had a computer and someone, you'd get a GIF off the net, and it wasn't just automatic that you could look at it, which seems bizarre. And so, you know, that was really popular because we had this tool that lets you look at, like, it was like 20 different formats eventually, and you could, you know, preview all your stuff.
Was that the one that did the PostScript stuff?
No. So then, then as a contract, we did, because we had contract work where we got to write actual apps. And the contract, I actually took the contract myself, and this was one of my most fun contracts, because it was just so well specified and so clean, and everything went off without a hitch. So this other company called Lighthouse Design, which was run by
Famous Shop.
Yeah, run by Jonathan Swartz, who went on to run Sun until Sun died. And the engineers in it are still like in the most powerful positions in the industry, basically.
Yeah.
So their chief of engineering was Kevin Steele, who went on to
OmniGraffle, right?
Yeah, he wrote OmniGraffle and you know, sells it through Omni. And then they have all these other dudes who work there. And like, for example, Roger Rosner, who now is, you know, running iApps at Apple, and came out with the, you know, exact same apps that Lighthouse had done, except at Apple, but largely with the same names. Like Pages actually is the same name as the Lighthouse app.
It's not the same code at all, right? It's a reboot.
No, there's some of it's the same code because he hired like three of the same engineers. I mean, I'm not saying
you don't know for sure, but yeah, it's yeah.
But it was the same engineers as well, and Roger Rosner. So it's like,
and Keynote looks identical to Concurrence.
Concurrence, yeah. And it's no surprise, right? It's like, wow, that's amazing that it's the same app. And I, you know, and I'm all for it. I'm like, yes, those were beautiful, wonderful apps, and you know, the world should see them and appreciate how great they are. Yeah. But anyway, I think it's really funny. So Lighthouse had one of the world's best salespeople in the world. Like this dude could sell, you know, anything to anyone, right? He could sell sand to a Bedouin. And they were totally embedded with the NSA and the NRO. And this was actually before the NRO had come out. So we were dealing with clients who couldn't tell us what they were. And they always just said Air Force. And so we had all these clients and we'd just be like, oh, you work for the Air Force? So like, yep, Air Force. And they had these cards on them that are just like, you know, my name is John Smith. And then it would just say Air Force. And, you know, it was like Arrested Development, where it's like, Mom, I'm going off to Army today. You know, like, you're like, oh, you work for Air Force, huh? Yeah, Air Force. Like, just Air Force? I mean, is that a thing? You don't really have a rank or anything. Nope, Air Force. and then when you pick up the number there, and when you call them, because, you know, they're not going to say NRO or whatever, right?
Right.
And they're also not going to give their name because you could just be, you know, dialing it. Just
random number, yeah.
Right? So you pick up and they give you the last three numbers you dial. So they pick up and they go 343. And you're like, hi, is this John Smith from Air Force? Yeah. Like, great, Air Force.
That's awesome.
It was really funny. The story.
Weird. So what were you doing for them?
Well, so they wanted a PDF viewer.
Okay. Yeah.
This new format called PDF.
Yeah.
And there was nothing on NextNet that could view it. And the NRO and I think the NSA as well were really deep in Next. They had just buttloads of them.
Bill Baumgarten has an awesome story about selling Next to, I'm not sure if it's the CIA or the NSA, but it involves like basically a dead drop.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So like when we sold OmniWeb to them, because they were one of our first clients, like we were giving away OmniWeb for free, version one, right?
Yeah.
And the Air Force calls us and they're like, hi, I'm Bob Smith from the Air Force. And we love it. So we'd like to buy it. And I was like, I take the call and I'm like, I'm the world's greatest businessman, right? I'm like, well, we're giving it away. So go buy. And they're like, no. That's not how we do things in the Air Force. We need to procure it from you and we need to pay or we can't use it. And I'm like, okay, how much would you like to pay? And they're like, $12,000. I'm like, all right, we'll take it.
Yeah.
And so they're like, all right, so when the check arrives, it's going to be from a company called Collins International. And I hope I'm not giving away state secrets because that's the actual name. John Smith is not really from the Air Force, by the way.
Yeah.
But the Collins International or maybe it's Rollins International. I guess, it's lost its own time. Anyway, and they're like, this is just, it's a company that we do some purchasing from when Air Force so that we don't have to ship it to Air Force. And I'm like, right. I mean, absolutely. And then
whatever you have to say, just.
Yeah, I know. And so they said, this check. And I was like, great. I wish we just framed it instead of cashing it. Cause I mean, it's, awesome to get, your actual check from the actual NSA. Yeah. And then they're having some trouble and they actually called us for support. And it was the most hilarious thing in the world. Cause they're just people too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they call us up and they're like, hi, I'm calling about, OmniWeb have trouble. And I'm like, oh, great. Well, we have, 200,000 people who are using it for free and a couple paid customers. And we don't support the free customers over the phone. Cause otherwise they'd be bankrupt. So who are you again? And the guy's like, oh, hold on. And then you hear phone muffling. It's like, that's who you are. He goes, Rollins. Rollins International. I'm Rollins International. And I'm like, Rollins. Oh, hi, Rollins International. Yes. Right. Of course. Our most valued customer. And so I'm like, what's the problem? And they're like, well, we're running it. And it's like, it's having trouble. It's getting timeouts on our network. And I'm like, well, that's weird. And they're like, well, the thing is, they're not running our own network. And I'm like, well, I mean, I'm a pretty tech person, I'm saying this.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've been around. I know 10 base 2 and 10 base T. I've seen star topologies. I know Apollo domain, right? You can go ahead and tell me. And he's like, no, I can't. I'm like, no. Just which network, what kind of network are you running? He's like, I actually can't tell you. It's a thing that we've had since before Ethernet.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's a magic thing. Don't ask questions.
We have a network internally that's before Ethernet, and it's running at this weird speed. And it quotes me a speed. It's like, it runs at 48.27 bits.
It's just something totally weird.
I don't know how to debug. Can I remotely debug in your machine? No. Can I? No. So, I don't know how that ever got resolved.
Well, not much you can do for Rollins International if they're not going to.
Yeah, you got to help me out, Rollins.
It was probably that VM thing that Avi yelled at you about.
Yeah, no, it probably was. the other funny thing we did is once we were at a trade show at the Next World Expo, and all the NSA and NRO guys were there with their cards, the Air Force cards. And of course, Lighthouse is deeply in bed with them. So Jonathan Swartz, the president and, very official, very grown up, was talking with all of his contacts and the intelligence agencies. And and I do this faux pas, this huge faux pas where I'm like, it's like John Smith comes up to me and is talking. He's like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, here's my card. And he gives me his card. And it's like Langley, Virginia. And I'm like, great, Air Force in Langley, Virginia. Big Air Force base there, I guess. And then another guy comes up and it's like, oh, you know, this is Bob Jim. And, you know, he's also Air Force Langley, Virginia. I'm like, oh, really? Do you work with Bob Smith? Oof. And the guy glares at me, just daggers. Like, because like you're in the same office, like just I would have thought you'd know him. It's like, yeah. And just everyone in the conversation gets it but me, and I'm like, why?
Yeah. It's a total, yeah, such an innocent thing. It's like, yeah.
I'm like, oh, different branch of the Air Force then is what I'm getting.
Mysterious. Yeah. So eventually you guys have you transition into a product company, right?
Yeah. So then
within a few years.
One of the first things is Lighthouse comes to us and says, all right, the Air Force wants a PDF viewer. And I'm like, great, I'll do it. And so I'm like, if you give me a month, I'll write a PDF viewer and it'll view PDF 1.1 perfectly. It'll be fast and beautiful, and I'll charge you the, you know, outrageous price of $100,000. I was like, this is the most obscene thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
And they're like, sold, don't care. Actually, I think it went the other way. I think they said, look, if you can do it in a month, we'll give you $100,000 because the Air Force wants it yesterday and they have an unlimited amount of money. So just if you do that, and I'm like, oh, holy shit. Okay. Right. Cause I would never ask for that much money. I'm realizing that now. It would be crazy. So I'm like, and so I sat down, I programmed it. I, you know, consulted with Ken some on it, and, you know, we came up with some cool ideas on how to optimize it. Made this beautiful PDF. You're way better than what Adobe had at the time. Like, it launched faster than Adobe's Acrobat.
Acrobat.
It didn't have 72 auxiliary windows. It just had one window where you saw your PDF document. I know that's a real revolution. Like, it still makes me mad to this day when people launch Acrobat. I'm like, that is just so shitty.
Yeah.
All this stuff. And then they're like, great. The Air Force loves it. But PDF 1.2 is out now. And also, they want to be able to copy and paste. And I'm like, well, you can't copy and paste. PDF is unstructured. They're like, well, they want it.
Yeah.
Figure it out. And I'm like, okay. But it's going to cost another $100,000. They're like, fine. Don't care. And so I do PDF 1.2 and copy and paste, and they pay me. I'm like, yay.
Does EPS too?
No.
Okay.
But then Apple comes to us and they're like, oh my God, you've got a PDF viewer. Everyone else, you know, PDF looks like it's the way of the future. We want to bundle with PDF viewer. And I'm like, great. I'll license it to you. You can bundle with it. And they're like, great. And so then they bundle with it and pay us some more money. I don't even remember how much, but more money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, I've been paid three times for the same product. And then says, oh, okay, so we're working on this new thing, graphics system, Core Graphics, right? This was before they strike. They knew they had to get away from
PostScript. PostScript. Yeah.
Because
we talked to, do you know Gelfman, David Gelfman?
I know the name. I don't know.
Yeah, he did a lot of the printing. He worked on the PostScript 2 spec and stuff like that.
Cool.
Anyway, he was at Apple. He was involved with that kind of stuff on their side.
Yeah. I mean, PostScript was neat, but, you know, I'm happy we have Core Graphics. So,
yeah.
But so they're like, we're going to invent this thing called Core Graphics, and we need PDF rendering. You know, we're going to it's going to be our native file format to do it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you've already built a parser and everything. So can we license the actual source code to OmniPDF?
Mm.
Number four. And I'm like, sure. And so they give me more money and they license the source code. So this is my
great. I never knew that.
Story. I managed to sell the same program four times, and, you know, twice to one customer and twice to another customer. I'm like, yay! So I'm told the postscript, haha, to all this is they didn't actually use my object-oriented PDF reader because everybody was always so afraid, you know, oh, objects are slow, which is crazy because really, you know, memory management is slow, and if you do it correctly, it doesn't. But whatever.
Yeah.
So they rewrote the whole thing in C++. My actual source code is not in Core Graphics, but they did pay me for it. So, you know, so
good enough. It's probably works out better because that way you get your money and you don't have to. They never bother you again.
Yeah, that was the funny thing. Yeah, they really did never call me again.
So what comes next? When does OmniWeb come up?
Well, so we made OmniWeb, like, it was almost our first product. We did OmniImage, and then OmniWeb was really early. Like, it was like 94.
Oh, that is early.
Yeah. No, OmniWeb is the oldest graphical web browser in existence. It predates IE by like 2 years. It predates anything even close. I mean, even NCSA Mosaic was a year after us. We beat everything. So the World Wide Web app was written on Next machines. And then they started porting it to other machines they had some library, and then and National Center for Supercomputers did their, you know, stuff with Mosaic and started doing it on Windows and things. I think they did on Unix on X11 first, I'm not sure. Anyway, so, and it was starting to gain traction. We were visiting Lighthouse once, and a guy there named Ray Ryan, who now actually works at Google, or no, sorry, Square, it was Google, Square, Square Up, the payment processor. So I actually just ran into him again recently, which, you know, is really funny to me. I'm just like, what? You're from a previous life. How can you be like, active in what's, you know, the exciting stuff that's going on now?
Yeah.
So anyway, he showed this to us. He was like one of those people that really loved new technologies and stuff. And he's like, check out this thing called the World Wide Web. And I was just like, completely, it was like, I don't get it. Like, we've got Gopher. We've got FTP. I don't understand what this is better. And he's like, well, you know, you can get little snippets of text. I'm like, well, the new Gopher clients have inline text rendering. So, I mean, you're like, it is funny because, you know, while the World of Web is an incredible achievement, Gopher was actually kind of already evolving towards that.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting.
And then it just, they just did it better and more standard. But it is interesting because, you know, it's one of the things where, you know, nothing is really invented in a vacuum, right? Like, things evolve and people realize what they want, and then one person wins.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were like, I don't really get it. Or I was like that. We went back, you know, to Seattle, and Ken downloaded the client, and we played with it for like a day. Ken and Tim and I looked at it. And interestingly, one of the first like places on the web was, there's a city in Washington, which decided to make a website. And it's so bizarre because this is like, you know, before cities had websites, you know,
back some nerd at that city council.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, like, I didn't know of any other ones, but this was like, I think probably one of the ones linked from the NCSA homepage. And so it was the city of Squim, which is pronounced S-E-Q-U-I-M. And like one of the things on it, because back then the net was very multimedia. It was all about, you know, we can embed sounds or whatever. And so you'd click on their homepage, and it just was like, you know, City of Squim, Washington. And then underneath it's just a sound file. And you click on it, and the sound file is this guy in this incredibly deadpan voice saying, Squim, it's pronounced Squim. That was their whole thing. That's it. That was Squim, Washington. And we're like, wow, this is the future. You know, like we're sold. We're like, yep. We got it. Yep. So,
that's great.
So we're like, this is amazing. But, you know, of course, the next client was the old World Wide Web.app, which was in really shape because, you know, they'd gone on to bigger, better things. And
that was pre-foundation too, right?
I think we're post-foundation at this time, but I'm not sure. So we're all like, I'm like, you know, neat, whatever. And Ken's like, ah, that's cool. We should play with this. And I'm like, man, you know, we got other stuff to do. And so, you know, being Ken, like the next afternoon, we all get in the office, and Ken's like, so last night I went home and wrote a web browser. And he shows us a web browser, and it like displays text and sound and images. And I'm like, oh, well, I can do this and this. I can make H2 work. I can do this. And so then we all just started hacking this web browser, you know, for no reason. I mean, it wasn't like we had a plan. We were just going to give it away. We just wanted to write it. And so we wrote OmniWeb 1 and shipped it on the next, and, you know, people liked it. And there was a point in time where we were told when Rhapsody was first shipping, and there was an IE version on Rhapsody, and I think even Mac OS 10.0, I'm not sure, I'm not good at dates, but there was a time when IE was shipping on it, and we were shipping on it, and we still had the majority market share over IE on our platform. And we were like,
yeah, I know. Well, you were way better in those days.
Yeah, way better in those days. Then, you know, we didn't really have the team. Like, I promise, you know, you give away a product, it's really hard to make money.
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, it's a pretty complicated product.
Yeah.
And the web starts evolving, like, real quick around that time, too.
Yeah. I mean, it was literally, it was the hardest thing I'd ever worked on, and the least the least rewarding per effort, because you just, the amount of time you spent trying to make up for bad pages or bugs in other clients was phenomenal, and it was worse back then than it is now, where people actually sort of agree, like, all right, let's be a little more strict.
Yeah.
But one of the things we actually had to do back then is there was a browser that if you passed in a color in your HTML and you typed an O instead of a zero, it accepted it.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
And so we actually, like, we had to make it compatible because everyone's like, the colors are coming up wrong. And I'm like, because you typed them wrong, idiot face. And they're like, well, it works in IE. And I'm like, you should stab yourself.
That's annoying.
It was so annoying.
That's like some jerk at Microsoft just thinks that's a cute idea.
No, I think actually we decided we had figured out an algorithm that did it. Like, I think I want to say, and this is I'm making this story up, but it's likely what happened.
Yeah.
I want to say that Ken looked in the source code of Netscape or Mosaic or whatever, and discovered that just the way the algorithm worked is if it hit something that it didn't recognize,
turns it to be zero.
So it turned into zero. And so we were like, bah! But all of the web was like that, and it was not fun. It was just horrifying, and I never want to be in that position again where I'm writing to a spec that's like not a spec, and the public edits files by hand, and you're supposed to do it, and you're supposed to be compatible with other things. So I basically vowed I'm never going to try to, you know, be compatible with other programs again, because it's just not fun.
Yeah, you almost can't win, right?
Yeah, there's just nothing. You can spend all your time being exactly like them, and then people are like, well, I'll just use them instead. And you're like, oh, yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Right. So eventually you leave OmniGroup and start Delicious Monster.
Yeah, in, I guess, 2004. January, March.
Yeah. So you've been at, Omni was 12 years, I guess? 10, 12 years?
I'd read for 9, and after 9 years, Ken was like, I want to be the CEO now. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, well, you can be president. And I'm like, okay. And then turned out being president didn't mean much. Like, they put nobody under me and nobody answered to me. So I quickly found out that I had no authority of any sort.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, this is lame. I don't want to be the president in these situations.
Yeah.
And so I stepped down as president, and I was just an engineer for a year, and then
just time for something new, right?
Yeah, well, you know, they actually asked me to leave. They said, well, they didn't ask me to leave. They called me on a Friday and told me I was gone and I needed to clean up my desk. So I was like, wow, that's very surprising. So I, you know, grabbed a couple of things from mine, and I grabbed my cat because I had a cat that was living in the office. I'm like, well, I'm taking this cat. And they're like, ah, that's a friendly cat. I'm like, yeah, well. So I took my cat, Schmop.
I like that. I haven't met that cat.
Yeah. Schmop is a great cat. Just a cat. So you
head out with Mike Mattis to start up Delicious Monster.
Yeah. Mike had been fired a couple months before. And largely just because he was, you know, he had his own ideas. And if you went against him, he would just ignore you. And so then I started Delicious Monster with Mike. And Mike had already come up with the idea of, you know, he wanted to start a company, and he had some cool ideas for a company. He wanted to just like gather together some people that were working on shareware and then make their stuff really cool and then take half of their money.
Where did the name come from?
His name, I think, was going to be called something like Aftworks or something, with like a X or something. It was very German sounding. I think that's actually real. And I'm just stealing that name, but it was something like that. It was a very like Germany, you know, worksy, you know, whatever. And I was like, man, I hate that name. And I had vowed back when I was at Omni, because I was always paying attention to the names of all the game companies, because they're always so funny, you know, yeah. Naughty Dog and, you know, all these. I'm like, game company names are so creative. And I'm like, my mom had given me this gigantic plan, 7 feet tall, which was a, people know it as a Mexican fern or a window leaf fern. But its Latin name is Monstera Deliciosa, which means delicious monster. And I was like, oh my God, delicious monster is such a just beautiful turn of phrase. And I vowed, you know, if I ever have another company, I told the guys at Omni this like, you know, years before. I'm like, if I ever have another company, I'm going to call it delicious monster. So the one argument I won with Mike was we decided to name the company Delicious Monster. And so we had these three guys we were like trying to partner with their shareware, but like two of them, we were kind of like, meh on. And then the third guy was working on one of the many, many, many apps for cataloging all your stuff that existed then. And, you know, and they were all really shitty, just deeply, deeply shitty. And I mean, working with Mike was just a dream. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. He worked all the time. Every moment he was awake, he was working. He was constantly coming up with ideas, constantly refining things, just refining interactions. Every time I would do, you know, anything on the program, he'd be like, well, yeah, but can it be easier? And I'm like, well, no, you have to be able to press this button. Well, what if you just understood what the user wants? I'm like, there's no way to just understand what the user wants in this case, unless you did this and this. Well, can't you just do that? Well, yeah, maybe. And then the next day I'd be like, look, I may do this. He's like, yeah, but the button's still ugly. Can you just do this and this? I'm like, oh my God. And, you know, and I wanted to strangle him for 7 months, but, you know, start to finish, it was 7 months. We shipped in November. And it was just incredible success, biggest success in my life. And just, enormous first day sales, enormous first week sales.
Changed the industry.
Well, thank you.
The Mac software industry. Yeah. No, really it did. It informed so much that came after it.
Yeah. I mean, I credit Mike for that. I mean, he was, you know, his UI skills, and at the time, you know, he's like, I think he just turned 18 and still he was just the king of UI. It was just stunning. And yeah, it was a really fun project. And then after a year of that, Mike, you know, got bored and restless, and he had been planning out Delicious Library 2, but we couldn't, you know, we were still trying to get different things working in one and, you know, do updates and stuff. And he's like, I'm bored. Like, you guys aren't even working on two yet. And I don't want to sit here and watch you fix bugs. And so.
Yeah. Well, it's like a lot of work goes into a product that you don't necessarily see. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you got to, you know, all the bug reports and fixing little weird edge cases. And again, you're working against the Amazon API.
Yeah.
So there's probably weird stuff in that, or, you know, fixing up the barcode scanner because the EyeSight camera doesn't autofocus anymore.
Yeah, that was a big thing. Huge.
That was an amazing feature. That was one of two things were cool. I mean, obviously the look of the app and the bookshelf was like mind-bending at the time. And the barcode scanner.
Yeah, that one was actually all my idea. I was proud of that. So originally we were working with, you know, this kid on his program. We were just supposed to be like providing advice and guidance and stuff. And I was like, hey, you know, you should write a barcode scanner. And he was like, oh, okay. And then he didn't. And I was like, no, you should do it this way. And he's like, oh, okay. And I'm like, no, really, seriously, do this. And he's like, and I finally realized he just, you know, he was very shy about just saying, there's no way in fuck I can do this. Because he was literally like 14. And an amazing programmer for 14. And I have no doubt that today he is just a incredible success. He's at 14, he was selling, you know, this other program and making just mad bank.
I didn't know he was that young at the time.
Yeah.
Because I had heard of him and I'd heard of the product.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
But so then I was like, all right, I'm going to write this. And so I wrote the barcode scanner and then started just writing the whole program. But yeah, at the time it was really interesting because some people had thought to try to read barcodes with computer cameras attached to computers, and all the research was around the traditional computer vision approach, where they're like, let's take a frame and then analyze that frame laboriously to see where we think, you know, the squares are and the non-squares. Mm-hmm. And then let's, you know, have a probability of the barcodes in this area. And then let's, you know, take the image and rotate it so the barcode is facing straight up, and then maybe de-skew it. And then once we've done that, you know, let's try to read, like, right? And so they're doing all this incredibly complex image recognition and image processing, all of them.
Yeah.
And I, so I tested some of the public domain ones, and they, you know, I got zero successes, and it took between 3 and 5 seconds per picture for it to decide that it was failing. And so I looked at barcodes, and I didn't know anything about barcodes when I started, and they are just beautiful. Oh, the UPC barcode is a thing of absolute beauty. If you like machine language programming, you have to look at it, because it is the perfect encapsulation of, like, being a very reliable way to encode data in the absolute sort of minimum amount of space given the constraints.
Yeah.
You know,
you can just print them on anything, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's just stunning. Like, you can have your scanner tilted, you know, up to 30 degrees and it'll still read. You can have them printed, you can be, you know, between 1 inch and, you know, 9 inches away and it'll still read. You can be, and, you know, with, you know, not complicated readers.
Mm-hmm.
It's this amazing standard. You can be upside down or upside up and it reads either way. It's just freaking amazing. So I looked at it and it was really cool, and I finally realized, you know, well, the way, you know, a normal scanner works, it doesn't take a whole picture, right? There's a line, a laser plays across the surface and measures the intensity at any point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, well, then in theory, and this was the big thing. And back then, this, you know, everyone who's done a barcode framework, and now everybody's done it. Mm-hmm. It's like probably first year CS now.
I think it's in iOS 7.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. It was on a public slide, so I don't feel like an ass for saying that.
No.
But anyway, go ahead.
So the big realization, and as well as, you know, like, duh, is I'm like, this isn't a two-dimensional problem. It's a one-dimensional problem. There's just, we need to just take the middle line of the camera and turn it black and white, and then just look at it as a series of intensities on a single line. You don't need to rotate the image, because barcodes are already written so that they're variable speed inherently. There's no way anybody holding a barcode scanner could be like, you know, oh, it always has to be exactly face up, right? It was written with the understanding that it's variable speed. And since we had perfect focus back then, the first algorithm really was just read the center line, figure out where there are areas that are at least 1/2 inch of white space, because the requirement is 1/2 inch of white space around a barcode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then between any two pairs of 1/2 inch white spaces, do a sample the line at every 1/112th of that space, so that you're reading 112 data points for 112 bars. It might actually be 100. Don't quote me on this. But yeah, so you do that, and then anything that's above 50% is black, and below 50% is white, and now you have barcode. You read it, that's so butt simple. I could do 2,000 frames a second instead of one frame every 5 and fail.
Yeah.
And so it was just amazing. I was like, oh my God. And then, of course, you know, we wanted to make it a little more flexible for different lights. So we did some tweaks on that, and then we did some skewing tweaks, and then we did some other tweaks and tweaks and tweaks and tweaks. But the basic algorithm, but simple. But no one had done it before. And then they introduced the cameras that don't focus, and I'm like, oh great, now we have to deal with blurry images.
Yeah.
I had no idea how we were going to do it, because it turned out the blur was enough that
it threw off the sensing of the highs and lows, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, it was the camera image was blurry enough that you could have a white line and a dark line is what you're supposed to read,
mm-hmm.
but the white portion could actually be darker than the dark portion because of the big dark blob to the right of it that is pulling it down too, and it could actually just pull it down farther than the actual. So you couldn't do any sort of relative metric. There was no way to do it relative.
That's kind of stinks.
Blurring was blooming out too much. And so we actually had to do something where
the signal kind of thing? Like
what we do is, and it's so awesome. the fundamental algorithm, the brief version, is we generate every conceivable barcode,
mm-hmm.
and then we blur them, and then we compare it against what we get. And when But when one of them matches the buffer, we go, oh, that's it. That's our barcode.
That is incredible.
I know, right? And as far as I know, nobody's come up with a different way to do it. So of course, you know, you're immediately like, every conceivable barcode, come on, I'm doing it in my head. There's 13 digits in a barcode. It would take you forever. And so then the real answer is, of course, we don't actually generate every conceivable one, because the blur, the maximum blur, is actually only about one digit wide. So all you have to do is generate every pair or every triad of digits, and then match the triad against subpart. And then
that is hilarious.
Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea.
We were the only ones. So we were the only ones to have barcodes for the first like year and a half, I think. And then the ZXing library came out. But the actual tricky part of doing barcodes wasn't the ones in the focus camera. It wasn't that. It wasn't the algorithm I came up with. It was that I also had figured out how to focus the eyesight, and no one had ever figured that out before. And as far as I know, I was the only person who ever did figure it out, because ZXing was actually based on some work that I posted on the net, that I said, I have finally figured out how to focus this camera using this incredibly obscure interface called IIDC, which was just horrifying.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember you posting that article, and I glazed over.
Yeah.
Like, I looked at it, I'm like, I don't even want to know how to do this thing.
So scary.
Yeah.
But so that was like the key to figuring out. But then we did the non-focusing one, and then we had that, I think, for about 2 years, where the only people that did it, and then some people started figuring it out. And now, you know, of course, it's everybody and their dog has a barcode scanner. Delicious Library 3 actually does have a new generation of barcode scanner in it. We rewrote the whole thing from the ground up so that it's now completely object-oriented instead of being just monolithic, so it's more flexible, which let us plug in these profiles so that we can actually have it tuned for different devices and different cameras. And we actually looked at the camera we have.
Good idea.
And it uses the threading stuff, the Grand Central Dispatch. So on iOS and on macOS, it's now multi-threaded and really cool. And we can actually, you know, decide how much of the CPU we want to burn. And so we're always like trying to trade off, because, you know, like on a phone, you don't want to burn too much CPU. Trying to scan, and on a plugged-in computer, you know, burn all the CPU you want. Whee!
That's cool. Okay, so DL1 chips, DL2 chips eventually. Meanwhile, you've hired some people. Basically, everybody you've hired has gone on to do really good things.
Yeah, the first
you got a knack for that. Yeah,
went on to Apple, so it was It was like downright eerie. It was like, what's happening?
So Mattis went to Apple.
Yeah.
On iOS, iPhone.
Yeah.
Lucas?
Lucas went to Apple. Before him, Tim Omrenick went to Apple.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about
Tim. He had a support guy, Drew Hamlin, who went to Apple. We had Scott Meyer was doing support and website for us. He went to Apple. Mike Lee went to Apple. And then Terry Phillips went to Apple.
Yeah. Lucas, did you mention Lucas?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, yeah. So good run.
That was a lot of Apple.
Yeah. You know how to pick them.
I guess. Or they know how to pick them. From me. Yeah. So yeah, I've had various programmers over the last. The most I ever had was Lucas and Mike were working together. So I had like three, which was like huge for me. I'm like, so many people.
Yeah.
And that was one of the problems at Omni, was I'm not a good manager, and I don't really enjoy managing. I like programming, and I love working with people. I just don't like managing. And so it's really hard for me, because, you know, I need somebody that doesn't really want, you know, management, but wants to work with me. And that's like, I don't even know if that's a thing.
Collaboration.
Yeah. Yeah. So we came up with Delicious Library 2 and, you know, added a bunch of stuff for people. And honestly, I wasn't super happy with Delicious Library 2. I felt like,
oh no. Huh.
Yeah. I just felt like it wasn't, we tried to do so much stuff. We tried to move to core animation, which was, you know, new back then. And we did core animation. And, you know, it made our graphics faster, and we were able to do some neat effects, but it was a major, major architectural change for us. Mm-hmm. It involved just so much work to get everything to actually work correctly and be fast. And then at the same time, we...
See, I really was new back then. It was like, I think you guys won an ADA for DL2 before Core Animation was actually shipping.
Yes, yes. That's, I think, the only time they've done that. And we, I don't think we weren't shipping. It was, we were still in beta and we won an ADA. So it was,
yeah. Well, you required the OS to haven't come out the door yet.
And we were using Core Data, which was also brand new. Mm-hmm. And so we were like customer zero on those two things. And we're like,
how do you like Core Data?
It was so painful.
Yeah. Do you like it now?
You know, the Core Data really saved our butt and it was amazing. But, there are some design decisions in Core Data that have always bugged me. And
so every old school next guy I talked to just wants EOF back.
Yeah, I don't think I want EOF. Like, EOF was really heavyweight. For example, EOF was client server. So, you know, it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't the nice, you know, Core Data is neat because you actually run it locally and you would actually think about, you know, making it your document format. But there's some issues with Core Data that I just feel like they just messed up. Like, one of the things is if you try to access Core Data in Core Data, if you try to access an object and that object has been deleted, it throws an error. It just, and it's a hard error. It's an exception.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not acceptable. And I've argued this over and over with their leadership and they're like, well, you know, what we discovered in the UF days was people just, you know, did it and then just, you know, didn't handle the air condition. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But something in access it, just let it be. Because the object doesn't go away when you delete it, you know, from memory. It's still a valid object. You have a retain pointer on it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, so the correct response is if I ask anything, it should return nil or zero. It should just go, nope, 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 no, no, no.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, it should throw exceptions. And I'm like, okay, well, you're wrong, but whatever. And then now
exceptions to me should be super rare. And like that's.
Yes. No, it's not acceptable. But so then the problem is, then they're trying to design all these UI objects, right? And so they have collection view and outline view and all this, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the obvious things you might do is want your collection view backed by a database, right? Database of pictures. So the problem is if you delete something, and this is still a bug to this day, if you delete something from collection view and it sends a delete message to the underlying object, it will delete the Core Data object, which will then not go away from memory immediately, but will be deleted from the database. So then the collection view will start animating out this object that is now been deleted. And it'll say to the object, oh, I'm animating you out. So I want you to draw at 50% opacity. And it says, draw at 50% opacacity. I'm going to raise an exception. I can't possibly do that. Crash. And of course, you know, you say, well, you don't really draw your objects. And I say, no, no, but you're trying to draw the text on the object, for example, and it asks it what the text is and it crashes. Same thing with outline view. And so anything that you can't have Core Data touch the user interface at all, because if it does, then the animations that are now all over the system will always crash whenever you do a delete. Because, you know, think about delete from an outline view now, it slides out. Well, if it slides out, it's going to crash. And I'm like, that's really unacceptable. But then, the worst part is, so there's this flag on every Core Data object called is deleted, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you could probably just write some, like, wrapper methods to check that. Oh, wait. Is deleted is only valid for the millisecond that you say delete before you've called process pending changes. From then on, an is deleted object, a Core Data object will turn no to is deleted. If you delete an object and it's gone from the database, you say is deleted and it says nope, sure not.
Oh, you're kidding.
I am not kidding. Still to this day, it's a design decision. I'm like, that is so incredibly broken. They're like, well, see, what we meant with is deleted is, you know, is going to be deleted.
Is in the process of deleting in this cycle.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, that's a different goddamn thing. Give us a flag for is deleted so we can actually tell if our object is invalid. So then if you end up accessing one of these, like say you link to it and then you save your database, you get an error, you know, because you're trying to save an object that was deleted, right? What do you think that error is? Oh, I'll tell you what it is. It's this object cannot be saved because it's from a different managed object context than the managed object context of the object linking to it.
Oh, God.
That's how they tell you it's deleted.
That's unbelievable. Well, because I guess they stick it into a different marker. The marker's nil or something.
Because it's nil. Yes. So nil is different. They're like, technically, it's different because it's nil. And I'm like, that's the worst error message in the entire world.
That's horrible.
Still, to this day, we kind of.
But you're still on it, right? Like the DL3 has it?
DL3 is on it, but we ended up putting a layer of objects between us and the database. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, great. So you've invented this persistent object layer, but I need to make a shadow object for every single one and then observe the objects underneath me. And then, you can't just observe is deleted, of course, because that'll just crash. And I have to cache the values because if I try to ask it for like its name as it's deleting out, it'll just crash. So I have to cache a bunch of values. I was like, so we spend all our time, doing this horrifying stuff, and the flip side is, we get essentially instant saves. We've got people out there who have collections of literally 14,000 items and, they modify something and it saves instantly. And, the old version, if you had 300 items, it would take a minute to have to save that XML file, right?
So
for the next app we're working on, and I actually just finished, it only took a week. For the next app we're working on, we're actually doing a completely different style of database file format. And it's really cool. And you're the first to know. We are using Git.
Really?
We're using we're not like writing
that
out files.
Sounds crazy.
We're using the Git object database to store our because at its base, and I'm told that I'm not a Git expert by any means, although I know a lot more than I did in a week ago. But at its base, Git is just a way of associating voids with blobs in a tree. And everything else is piled on top of that. And so you can, you can use it as a generic fast data store.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And it gives you a bunch of cool things because if you want to share files with, somebody else, well, you could just, Git clone. Just clone your file to them. You could just send it off to GitHub, right? There's all these cool things you can do. There's a bunch more cool things.
I guess you could rewind your file format too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what we do is we actually checkpoint every undo. Every time you would normally do, register an undo event, we actually do a Git checkpoint. And then the undo event is just what we really register for the undo is just go back to this checkpoint in the Git file. And okay, so we've got perfect undo without having to write any undo code. Like we never have to again say prepare invocation or anything like that.
I'm impressed.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. And, I'm going to try stealing that idea.
You should. I got it actually from a programmer named Sean O'Brien who works for, let me get this right. I think it's called MacRad. No, wait, am I getting that right? Let me make sure I get it right. MacRabbit?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I know that company.
CSS Edit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he works for them and is also a friend. And he was like, we were looking at, so this is not for this library. I should be very clear. This is not for this library 4 or anything like that. It's a brand new product. And we're looking for a 4.0 format. And one of the things I suggested is I said to him, hey, what if we had persistent undo? What if we had an undo stack where you could quit and launch and you still have your stack there and you can still undo as much as you want? Just, why does that go away, right?
I think that's I love this idea because I do agree that that should be a necessity, especially with all of this stuff with Apple. Like you can opt in and Apple will quit your app in the background for you.
And the whole notion is we're trying to get to a world, and I support the way they did it was kind of horrible in 10.6 or but I support the notion of I should be able to just turn my computer off and turn it back on and it goes boop, here's every window and everything.
Yeah,
but then none of the apps restore their undo buffer, and some of them actually have horrible bugs because of that. There's some preview bugs that'll just kill you dead. So I'm like, well, what can we do? And then Sean was like, you should look into Git, and I'm like, what? That's crazy. And then I did it, and it turns out it's fast as hell. There's no no speed impediment, and it just has all these amazing neat effects because you could actually take your file. A user who's advanced at all could take their data file from our program and just move the head in the Git repository in Git or Gitbox or whatever. And then if you reload it in our app, it's just you're at a different undo state. You're like, yep, because we use the head to point to the current, like,
you know, that's the, pretty cool.
Where you are in the undo stack. And we actually save all the redos too. So, like, you can actually, you know, do a bunch of stuff, undo half of it, quit, restart, and then redo the rest. And it's all just, it's all right there waiting for you. But then,
yeah. Okay. The other, I'm impressed. I'm definitely going to look into that. Yeah.
The coolest part is that, you know, you can also, besides storing undo and redo, you've got snapshots of everything you've done ever in time. So you could have a time buffer and just have a time scrubber where you can just scrub across time and watch your document change, you know, since the beginning. Just watch it build. You know, even with undos and redos and all that stuff, you could just scrub across it. So.
Okay, I got to go. I'm going to start writing something now.
It's really cool because I thought, you know, I was like, ah, I'll just give it a try. And then, like, you know, 4 or 5 days later, we've got it working. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, my God. And it's performant and it has all the characteristics we want. And it's really neat because, you know, there's all these tools that Git has, right?
That you could use to, like, inspect your documents.
Yeah. So you could just use them to be like, oh, what did I change between this revision? Oh, I see. And, you know, in theory, someone else could send you another, could, you know, modify your file and send it to you, and you could actually merge it in to your repository and then, you know, read and change it.
Cool. I don't know about you. I'm not like a source control guy. I mean, I use it, obviously, religiously, but I'm not one of the guys that knows all the weird actual options and stuff.
Yeah, no, that's the thing is Git at the high level is such an incredible, like, ugly user experience abortion. Like, it's one of the worst things ever.
Yeah.
And then at the low level, it's just this amazingly beautiful, clean, you know, wonderful thing. And so I never thought about using it. And then I started using it low level. And then when I did that, I then understood why these high level conventions
exist,
you know, how they work. It's like learning machine language. And then I'm just in transfer. I'm like, this is really cool.
That's awesome. You went with SceneKit for DL3.
Yeah, we decided to try going full 3D. I think it's just beautiful. I think it's unbelievably,
I like the API for that. It's very basic. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very clean API. It was really well written. It was really, really stable as well. You know, we said, okay, we'll take like a week or so and see what we can get. And at the end of the week, we had, you know, a bookshelf with books on it that we'd done ourselves, and it looked really cool. And they had texture maps on them, and they had bump maps, and they had specular maps, and you know, we had light sourcing, and we had actually an environment map. So they're, you know, right now we turned down the effects so they're not too obnoxious. But like right now, if you zoom in on a book, especially in 3.1, and move around, you can see that it's actually reflecting a room. There's a real room that the whole everything is reflecting back at you from the books. So we had all this stuff after like 1 week, and we're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And we hired this really neat Canadian artist to do all our models. It's actually the one Graham Devine used back when he was for his recent iOS games.
That's a good recommendation.
Yeah, I was like, well, you're the biggest expert. Tell me. And this guy was just amazingly good and just phenomenally cheap, like way cheaper than getting like pixel images. Like amazingly cheaper. Yeah, like dollars. I mean, single dollars for models, like, you know, not like, you know, $15 would be an expensive model, like crazy.
That guy,
right?
That guy is undercharging.
I know. I was like, Jesus Christ, dude. But yeah, so it was really a great experience for us. And it's very performant, you know, on newer machines, it's faster than Core Animation. But then, unfortunately, the downside to this was there are some 2008 machines that really do not run SceneKit well at all right now.
Yeah. And well, I mean, you build for the future, right? Like, how long did DL2 ship for? Like 4 years, 5 years?
Yeah.
Quite a while. So, I mean, that was a long time. But, you know, this code base is going to last another roughly the same amount of time, right?
Yeah, it's depressing now because we've got a lot of customers that are like, I have a 2008 and this is just slow. And we're like, okay, this, but it's not even your chipset. It's a driver issue. The drivers for those machines just aren't there yet. And you know, we've been told this and we're kind of at Apple's mercy. And then, you know, the customers are like, yeah, whatever, you know, I've heard this before. Sure. It's all Apple's fault. I'm like, no, really, like If I could show you, you know, a different machine that's not supposed to be much faster, that's literally 10 times as fast as your machine.
Yeah.
And we didn't have access to this machine, so we couldn't figure out what, you know, we didn't see it when we were testing
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Can you turn off the environment map and do some of the...
Well, that's the thing is we could turn off, if we knew which ones to turn off, yeah, we could just turn them off for those machines and, you know, I'm sure it'd be great, but I don't know what the feature is that's killing them. And so we're trying to work with them and unfortunately it's you know, slow going to be like, you know, how do you, you know, I need to get you a special build and then
yeah,
try that out.
Yeah. Are you selling direct anymore? Sorry, go ahead.
A lot of people just, it's really weird. Like it's discouraging because a lot of people just say it's slow.
Oh, yeah. Like,
well, what's slow? Like, I mean, there's 100 different parts of this program. And then they'll, you know, it turns out they mean different things. So like one guy, you know, he had thousands of items. When he typed in the search box in 3.0, it was slow to produce results in the search box.
Mm.
And so, you know, Jonathan added a full index to everything and now typing results is instant. And so with him, you know, he's like, oh, it's fast now. Yeah. But I'm like, all I got was it's slow. And I'm like, what's slow? I can't, it's slow. No good. Can't.
It's not an actionable.
Yeah. I don't know how to do that. Yeah. Like I have 1700 items and searching is slow when I type. I'm like, ah, that I can do.
Yeah.
So we're still trying to narrow down the people that are like, okay, it's slow as in when you're in cover view mode, it's slow to scroll, it's slow to select. What's. Yeah.
Well, you were telling me a story at WWT actually about the table view.
Yeah. The table view. The new auto layout table views, and under 10.8, they are not fast. They are they're not at all fast. Like they do an auto layout pass, and it's like instead of having the table view have these optimized cells like the old days, which you know was obnoxious. I don't like cells, but they have you know hundreds and hundreds of subviews, and so they do an auto layout pass with hundreds of subviews, and it's just unbelievably pokey. And every time you scroll a single line, it's like, oh, we have to really auto layout everything.
Yeah, that's funny that the table view gets the slower than the fancy 3D rendered view.
Yeah, yeah. So it's so dog slow.
Oh, whatever.
But that's, yeah.
That's in fixed now, right?
Well, I can't comment.
Got it. Yeah.
On that.
Yeah.
We didn't fix it.
Understood. do you guys sell direct anymore?
Yeah, we actually did. For Bliss Library 2, it was like half our profit was direct.
Yeah.
For 3, it seems way more popular in the App Store, and I'm not sure why that is, but Bully for them.
Go ahead.
Bully for them.
Yeah, okay. For DL2, half the profit in... Over the life of the product or while you were selling in both stores?
While we're in both, it was doing really well in our direct store.
Hmm.
So and we more money, so that's nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So how do you feel about the App Store?
You know, I think it's a great thing. It was really upsetting to not have paid upgrades when we did this. And, you know, we've been asking for them forever and, you know, Apple just doesn't seem to be hearing it. And it's, you know, my argument is really strongly that without paid upgrades, you're encouraging people to write throwaway apps because there's no reason, you know, for us to write a 2.0 version if we can't get upgrade revenue. It doesn't.
No, you may as well do a different app so you can
sell. Might as well write a brand new app. Yeah. It's just the economics. You are incentivizing us. I don't think you're allowed to use this. But whatever, to write 1.0 versions and then just keep them barely up to date.
I think that's a philosophical thing. They're actually against it, or it's just something they haven't gotten around to yet.
I don't know. I think you know for their apps, they're sort of against it, and I think you know there may be some people who, you know, were thinking you know. Hey, it'd be nice if somebody buys an app and then they can just get updates forever. That's like they're thinking that's customer friendly, and I'm like, it's not actually customer friendly if
their app but it goes out of business.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I think what Apple's guilty of is optimizing for the most optimal case. because it's like, well, yeah, the Angry Birds guys can afford to make free level packs for Angry Birds because, you know, it's fucking Angry Birds. They've made $1 trillion.
Yeah. There's 900 versions of it.
Yeah, and there's 900 versions anyway. But the rest of us that aren't making games, which have always been one-offs, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, a real upgrade. We're, you know, we really live and die by our upgrade revenue. You know, and we do get a sales boost when we come out with a new, when new version. There is a, there is like more people buy the new version as well, but we depend on that upgrade revenue. And we just got, you know, slaughtered. Just tons of people are just like, you know, I can't believe you're not rewarding us loyal customers. And I'm like, I just lowered the price from $35 to $25. And, you know, the upgrade price to go from one to two is $20. Yeah. So it's not very much more. And I lowered the price for everybody because I knew I couldn't do upgrade pricing. So I just said, well, I'll just lower the price rather than everyone paying more.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait, well, you're not rewarding us specially.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I can't. And they're like, that sucks. And I'm like, but it's not me that's sucking, but I get, you know.
Well, yeah, and on the other hand, I mean.
One star.
They've been what? Yeah, fuck yeah. Well, I mean, what, they've been using your software for like 3-4 years. It's like, it's not a lot. Like $25 after 4 years of using the software for all of this new stuff is not asking a lot.
Yeah, but they just, they want some recognition that they've been using for longer. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, that's, you know, I do appreciate it. I really do.
Yeah.
But I can't do it.
Can't help you.
Yeah, we've got that feedback too. We've got people who are angry that other people are getting the discount that only they feel entitled to.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, well, I, you know, that's actually kind of an odd sentiment, but also
right, not very charitable.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, yeah, you know. And you know, and the other thing about Delicious Library is the 3 version. You know, we know that people are moving away from physical media, and so we said, you know, we've still got some cool stuff we want to do. But how do we make it relevant to people? And so, we decided to refocus around recommendations.
Yep.
And wishlist sort of dropped out of that. Like, you don't want to do recommendations without wishlist. Cause, and so we came up with this neat, you know, recommendations algorithm that's, you know, closer to Netflix's and farther from iTunes. Cause iTunes still just does the one-off, you know, you once rented Party Girl on Ice. Therefore, would you like to read, you know, what would you like to buy the movie Ice Shaving 3? Like, no, I'm sorry. I did not, like, I'm still haunted by these purchases because it doesn't look at the you know, gestalt of what I bought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we actually do that now where we're like, you know, we look at everything you bought and we score it all. And it's a really neat algorithm. We actually take into account like whether you've actually read a movie, a book or watched a movie and, you know, all these other little factors that would, you know, make a difference in the real world. Right. Like, you're probably more likely to want to buy a book in a series if you've read the other books in the series.
Right. Yeah.
So we do all this stuff, but I think, you know, I'm not really great at marketing. And I don't know that the message has gotten out that, like, we're not focusing on it being an app just for collecting books. If you're still one of those crazy people that collects physical books like me, it's about having, you know, this amazing recommendation engine. And then once you get recommendations, you can buy them any way you want. Yeah. Buy the iBooks, buy the Kindle. I like the recommendations engine because I, you know, I entered my sample library and I was like, oh, wow, these are giving me recommendations of things that I didn't know that existed that I actually really want. And I'm like, oh, buy that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, I think there's so much power in that, you know, like it's the next generation of what people talk about it like the next generation of the web is like, you know, personalized stuff. Like, we're not just doing search results, we're doing search results, but we know stuff about you that make them
damage. Right. Yeah.
This is one of those things where it's like, there's, you know, whatever, 7 million books on Amazon.com. So now the problem isn't selection. It's how do you find the one that you want? And I think if you could say to someone, you know, like, if you came up to me today and I believed you, if you weren't just lying, you said, I'll buy you a book and I'll charge you $5 extra, but I guarantee you'll love the book. I'd do it in a second, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no question. If I actually thought you'd do it, I'm like, well, why would you not pay $25 to get a program that's going to tell you all the books you're going to love and all the movies you're going to love and all that?
That's a good idea. I do like that about Netflix. Like,
yeah,
often it suggests stuff to me. I'm like, whatever. It looks lame, and then I try it and I'm like, you know what? I did like that.
Yeah. My biggest problem with Netflix is I have seen everything that it recommends for me. I've done too much. So it's like, you know, it's really accurate. It's like, we think you'll give Firefly 5 stars. I'm like, yep, I did.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we think you're going to love Arrested Development. You're right. I love it. Like,
it's a little bit. Yeah.
It's maddening because it's a little bit late to the party for me. And I'm like, darn it.
It's also odd if you have families and they have very different tastes, because then you have a lot of content that you've seen that's not you personally, but is someone in your family has seen.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things we added in List Library 3 for the first time, is we added the ability to rate things you don't own, which we never had, but, you know, is obviously vital to recommendations.
Right.
And so you can just search for things and then rate them right there in the search results as you see them. Because our whole idea was just try to encourage people to rate things. So like our design goal for this was make it so everywhere you see an item, you can just do one click and rate it. And then at the end, we ran out of time, and so we weren't able to figure out a good way to put rating stars on the cover view, because, you know, it's hard not to talk about.
Yeah.
We had some ideas, but it just didn't come together. But everywhere else in the program where you see something, you can, a book, or maybe you can just, there will always be a field that says, hey, you want to rate this right now? I mean, just, you know, while you're looking at it, just rate it.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, because, yeah, you don't want to have to, you know, get info on an item in order, because nobody's ever going to do it, right? Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Good call. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm really proud of the work I put into it. I'm also really happy to be working on this new app, because, you know, I've been working on Delicious Library now for 9 years.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to be on this other thing.
Fresh new thing, yeah.
It's interesting because you've always been trendsetting using the latest technologies. You love games. You don't make a game, but the apps that you make are highly gamified, and it seems like a very interesting nexus of all your personal passions in the apps.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And this next one is, it's an app that I have been thinking of since I was at Omni, and I think I started thinking about it in 2001, and the technologies have all finally arrived for it. So, and yeah, it's going to be much like that. The way I describe it to people is, I'm like, you know, hey, you want a program that does this, right? And they're like, yeah. And those programs already exist. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, have you ever used any? And they're like, no, they all suck. And I'm like, well, what if they were actually like this game, which this game actually does this, you know, does this thing that you want done in real life, but you can do it in the game. And they're like, oh yeah, if it worked like the game, I would do it. I'm like, so what we're saying is, right. You already kind of know what needs to be done. We just need to make it as simple as the game, and then everybody's got it.
Yeah. I actually think I know what whatever.
Yeah, I think we talked about
it. Yeah, we've talked about it before. I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, and it's Infinite Undo, so woo! I mean,
yeah, that's great.
Persistent Infinite Undo.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Okay, well, I guess we plugged everything, and I don't want to keep you forever.
Yeah. Thanks for giving me time to do some plugging. I love plugging.
Are you interested in any, I mean, WWC just happened. Is there any, you went to SceneKit and you did Core Animation. Is there anything that you're looking forward to playing with that Apple's announced so far? I mean, there was SpriteKit. They've showed off a lot of other interesting stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty excited about SpriteKit. And it's funny because, you know, I think internally there is maybe, you know, the tendency to feel like, SpriteKit competes with SceneKit, you know, because SceneKit's a hard sell, right? I mean, it's obviously a leap, and a lot of we've all seen 3D frameworks before, and we've all been like, bah, whatever. I think it's amazing. I think, you know, it's going to be used again and again if it's given a chance. But I think internally, you know, there might be some like, you know, well, we have SpriteKit. Do we really need a 3D one? You know, but that said, I think SpriteKit's amazing, and yeah. I totally want to play with it. I think Sprite, you know, SceneKit is different and amazing.
They're very different problem spaces, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But SpriteKit does offer, you know, some of the physics-y stuff. And I haven't seen very much on that. And so I need to go back and watch that talk. I caught like just bits of it. But that really excites me, because I think the physics-based is where we're going for all UI interactions. And that's actually the story of why Mattis left Apple, actually, is he was working on iPhoto, the one for the iPad. And he, this is so funny, because, you know, he's a high school dropout, and he's like, whatever, you can't teach me anything, I can, you know, learn myself. And he really could. And then he realizes very quickly that, you know, physics, the, you know, classes he decided to skip, contains the key to realistic feeling interfaces. And so he teaches himself all, you know, the Newtonian physics. Mm-hmm. And then he codes it all in Quartz Composer.
That is crazy.
And so he has all these Quartz Composer patches that use real Newtonian physics. And he showed it to me, and he's so proud. We're in an airport once, randomly to the randomly, and he just sits me down and shows me the stuff on the iPad. And he's like, or on his Mac, he's like, look at this. See, I've got all this. Here's my gravity constant. Here's my friction constant. Here's, you know, all these different constants. And I plug in these patches, and then all these objects, I just imply an impulse to them. And, you know, and then they just slow down naturally over time. So if I flick this photo, watch how, you know, it slows down, you know, completely correctly. Yeah. And I'm just like, you're a high school dropout? Like, I don't know anybody that graduated high school that could, you know, do this math.
Right.
Much less write a fucking Quartz Composer, which is, you know, yeah, probably the crazy part of it, a patch and Quartz Composer. But so, yeah, so he did it. iPhoto was really going to be entirely, it was supposed to be entirely physics, but it's really hard to do actual physics, or was hard to do actual physics in Quantumation. I don't know if Apple's announced anything on that, so I guess I'll shut my mouth. But it was hard. Mm-hmm. As of 10.8, it's hard to do actual physics in Quantumation. They just, you know, they give you sort of three options, right? You can do linear, you can do a thing that slows down, you can do a thing that speeds up as it goes on right. its path. But you can't say, oh, here's my gravity context, here's my, you know, yeah, all that. But I really do think that is the key to the future. Oh, so Mattis coded all that, and he was all excited about it. And the programmer was like, yeah, that's really hard. I'm just going to use, you know, ease in, ease out. And Mattis is like, you suck, I quit.
Ironically, iOS 7 has all that physics and particles in it.
Right, yeah. I mean, he was right.
I mean, well, the next thing he did, push, pop, press, very physics based.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. I mean, there's just, you know, I don't think he's the second coming of Christ or anything, but he is an absolute certified genius. Mm-hmm. I fully believe he'll be running Apple one day. I think it's still 20 years away, but I do think he'll be running Apple. I honestly do. And also, I would never bet him against him on user interface issues. Like, it's just stupid. Just don't. There's no point in doing it. he's good at that. That's great.
You know? Yeah. He's got such a good track record.
Not good at everything. You know, I'm probably a better driver than he is, but, you know, whatever.
That's great. Where do we find you online, Will?
Let's see. On Twitter, I'm Will Shipley, all one word with one L, because I lost my L to a hot French Canadian girl. 12th grade.
Zing.
She was like, you know, I think Will would be cool if it was spelled with one L. And for the rest of my life, I have spelled it with one L.
Are you serious? That's...
This is an absolute true story. Her name was Monica Beasley. She's a pretty blonde French Canadian.
Wow. Nice.
And I sat beside her in English, and I was madly in love with her. And she's like, I'd like your name better if it's spelled this way. And I'm like, done. Done and done. So
that's awesome. Yeah. That's my favorite story yet.
Glad you like it.
Whole podcast worthwhile.
All right.